Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 190 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her age.
Ah.
We have a terrific show coming up, and right before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on to iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show, because I'm just sitting here waiting to hear from you. Come on, man. It's all about feedback. We love it. All right. It's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life. It's all about her.
You know, when I do these podcasts for the for her, every now and again, I run into someone who I consider to be a true icon, someone who has been a maverick in her field, as she has touched all of our lives in a very special and unique way. And today I have one of those experiences that I'm going to share with you. I have with me the New York Times best-selling author, Mary Pfeiffer, Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. She graduated in cultural anthropology from the University of California at Berkeley. And guess what, Mary? I did too. I'm actually a Berkeley graduate.
That's very interesting.
I actually have 3 degrees from them. I got my baccalaureate in science, and then I got consecutive masters in public policy and public health. So you and I stomped the same streets, I'm sure. And Pete's
I'm
Coffee.
Sure.
Yes, bring it on. And received her PhD from the University of Nebraska in clinical psychology in 1977. She's worked most of her life as a therapist and has taught at the University of Nebraska and Nebraska Wesleyan University. She was a Rockefeller Scholar in Residence at Bellagio and has received 2 American Psychological Association presidential citations, one of which she returned to protest psychologists' involvement in enhanced interrogations in Guantanamo. She is the author of 10 books, including the famous, and I know that the mass majority of you have read this, Reviving Ophelia. And her latest is Women Rowing North, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. 3 of her books have been New York Times bestseller, and she is a contributing writer for the New York Times, and I just know that so many of you follow her on her op-eds when she writes. Mary, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be on.
I'm just, I don't even know where to begin. I wish I had like about 8 hours with you, but I'm going to wait until you come into our town in Washington, D.C., where we can all ask you questions, you know, person to person when you do one of your great readings at Politics and Prose here. The book is absolutely brilliant in the way that you captured where you are in your life now, because wasn't it 25 years ago that you wrote Reviving Ophelia?
Yes. In fact, there's going to be a new updated version of Reviving Ophelia that comes out this June that my daughter, who was in high school when I wrote that book, co-wrote with me. So we did a lot of new interviews and looked at new data and have updated that for 2019. So that's been
I love it. Well, if I want you back on so we can do that one too, because are you kidding me? With this large female audience we have, I think it's very relevant. So this is fantastic. I'm so glad you told me that. That is wonderful. This book here has just captured me. I'm kind of reading it like carrot cake, and just slice by slice, because it's so rich. Well, you're a lyrical writer. You're also a superb writer. I am a writer as well. And when I really see something as brilliant as this, it blows me away. I'm going to read a little opener here from your op-ed in the New York Times, dated January 12, 2019, The Joy of Being a Woman in Her 70s. When I told my friends I was writing a book on older women like us, they immediately protested. I am not old. What they meant was that they didn't act or feel like the cultural stereotypes of women their age. Old meant bossy, useless, unhappy, and in the way. Our country's ideas about old women are so toxic that almost no one, no matter her age, will admit she is old. Wow. Why did you write the book?
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do this?
Well, first of all, I'm always interested in the discrepancies between the cultural stories about people and the actual lived and felt experiences of those people. And one reason, for example, I wrote Reviving Ophelia was, as a therapist, what I was seeing in my office and with my daughter and her friends did not at all correspond to the cultural stories about teenage girls. And I started realizing it was a very toxic culture that was affecting teenage girls, not the dysfunctional family. I wanted to tell a different story about girls. Well, now I'm 71, and many of my friends and my siblings are entering this period of time between middle age and old age. And I wanted to explore it because the cultural stereotypes about who women are and how they feel as they grow older don't match my felt experience at all. In fact, one of the things that I noticed is almost all the women that I'm acquainted with say this is the happiest life stage of their life. And we now have research that shows that the happiest demographic group in the United States is older women, women over 65. So that statistic, plus my own experience, really made me want to explore, so what is going on in this life stage that's so catalytic for growth and makes so many women feel that they're in one of the richest, most interesting stages of their life?
And yet, ageism is so pervasive. It's just, it's no matter where you look, there it is. And we have people now beginning to take this on. I'm thrilled to see that you brought it up and you made it a big issue in the book and in your op-eds and your writings in general. It's interesting the way you said it. In America, ageism is a bigger problem for women than aging. I just found that fascinating.
Right.
What a solid sentence. What's that? What is all that about?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do with this book was really make it a piece of cultural therapy. In the sense, I think American culture continually miseducates people about both the nature of happiness and about their own potential to grow and empower themselves. So with women my age, I really wanted to explore our complexities and our opportunities for growth. The essential argument of women going north is that happiness is a choice and a skill, and that we all have the capacity to be happy. No matter what's going on, we can adapt to anything, and I mean anything. So I tried in this book not to focus on the cultural issues that we may or may not be able to change, but the issues that we as women have a great deal of control over. For example, we don't always have control over lookism in the culture and cultural stereotypes, but we do have choices we can make around our own attitudes and intentions that can lead us to a happier place and also a more, a bigger place. This life stage is full of potential because we're constantly oscillating between grief and loss and various kinds of despair, and on the other hand, bliss and authenticity and joy and calmness and peace. And it's that oscillation that is so important for growth. And so most women, by the time they're 70, have figured out what the skills are they need to grow, what kinds of attitudes they need to have to be happy. And it isn't that our external situations are so wonderful. It's that we have, to quote my friend Jane Jarvis, everything we need to be happy right between our ears.
Oh, I love that. That's absolutely correct. I mean, just hands down. You know, there was the whole book is just a mind blower for me. And again, I'm sitting here wall to wall hyperbole, I'm sure. It's just rare that I find a book that just resonates with almost every word. Now, you know, I'm a physician, and so immediately I, you know, ran to chapter 3, which is entitled The Worn Body. Oh, yes. And it's really interesting. You start with two quotes that really hit home. The first one is from Alexandra Robin. Dread of one's own aging leads to fear and dislike of old people, and the fear feeds upon itself. In Western society, this cycle of dread has been going on a long, long time. Then the second one was from Stephanie Sugars. We wither, sag, wrinkle, crinkle, tatter, and become marked by life's events. Time and gravity, air and water, wear us down. Each into a unique and precious beauty. Every bit as beautiful as a landscape or plant weathered by the seasons. Whoa, you know, blew me away with that. Now, you talk about something that happened with your hands in this chapter that I thought spoke to the whole issue of resilience. Can you share that?
Right, absolutely. Well, almost all women by the time they're 70 have some kind of limits on their activities. Perhaps their eyes aren't as good, they no longer jog, they no longer can play tennis or hike up a mountain with a backpack, etc. But in my case, probably when I was about somewhere between 65 and 68, I just wore out my hands. I'd been writing since I was a high school student. I was always a good student. I studied my way through a PhD. As a therapist, I took notes with every client every hour of the day. And by now I've written 10 books, which means I've actually written 100 books and thrown 90 books away. So my hands just were shot, and I started having a lot of pain. I couldn't use them. I couldn't do very simple things like use a paper clip or scissors or hold a pen. And I went to a physical therapist. He recommended some exercises. I went back to him and he said, these exercises aren't going to help your hands. Your hands are really, they're going to need some surgery, but they're never going to work very well again. And so I remember that day I went home. And it was snowing. I live in Nebraska. And I just almost felt like the snow was crying tears. I was so sad, and I just felt so broken by that. But and he had told me not to write, that it was too hard on my hands. But I decided, well, what do I do when I feel this much despair? I write in my journal. So I went and I got out a file folder that happened to have a postcard of one of my books, Writing to Change the World, on it. And as I picked it up, I saw that smiling picture of me with the title, Writing to Change the World. And it really made me so angry. And I took a magic marker and I just slashed across my face and said, Mary Pfeiffer, not writing to change the world. Because that's how I felt at that moment. But then, for some reason, it struck me as funny. And I started laughing. And when I started laughing, I started getting better. And I started really realizing, you know, my situation has some comic potential. Maybe I can eventually write about that. And of course, I saw the surgeon. I've had surgeries. And there's many things I can't do now. I can't chop vegetables. I can't garden. I can't write very much on my own. I usually have someone sit by me and type into a computer as I talk. But on the other hand, one of the points of this story that I told is I've adapted. And that was several years ago. And I went from that feeling we always have when we experience a catastrophe, which is why me, to a feeling of why not me? These things happen to almost all of us. And now when people ask me about my hands, I almost have to stop and think, well, what do they mean? Oh, yeah, that's right. My hands are damaged. I've almost forgotten that because I figured so many workarounds. And that's what most of us are capable of doing. by the time we're this age. We know how to do workarounds. Also, the other thing I argue in this book is that emergencies call for emergent behavior. Now, we all suffer, but we don't all grow. But if we see loss, trauma, emergencies as an opportunity to grow bigger, that's what happens to us. If we believe in our potential to grow, we can grow. And that's really the beautiful thing about this life stage, is its potential for spiritual growth, emotional growth, growth in authenticity and honesty, and growth in the moral imagination.
I love it. I mean, I'm just sitting here listening to you, remembering that, you know, in most of my books, I came up with, you know, the nice thing, as you know, about writing books, is you can make things up as you go along. You can make some words up if they don't exist. So I came up with A Square in It Through Life, adapting and adjusting. I happen to be a stress physiologist, and so I spent a lot of time looking at stress and stress hormone. And at the end of the day, you know, it's not the strongest who survive. It's not the smartest who survive. It's those who can adapt and adjust who survive. And when I was reading this beautiful chapter of yours, it just was wall-to-wall, learning how to accommodate, adapt, adjust, change That's attitude, right. reframe, redefine. So, you know, it from what I saw, what I was reading, was you were redefining normal. And so the new normal is, right. Okay, three fingers are out for the count. But I still got seven, so, you know, bring it on. Let's make it work one way or the other. You summarize this beautifully toward the end of the chapter. As we age, we all experience worn bodies. And that's in quotes, just like the title of the chapter. The luckiest suffer small losses and minor health issues. Others must face dire health emergencies. Most of us, fall in between these two extremes. We work harder at being healthy, and yet we experience more illnesses and pain. This life stage requires a constant process of, here we go, adjustment and accommodation. We suffer a setback, we regain homeostasis, and soon we are enjoying our lives again. I just love the way that sounds. It just, I think it's very comforting right. to people. Does that make sense? It sounds right. so comforting.
Absolutely. Well, there's several life skills I mentioned in particular. And one of them is humor and being able to joke about things. That's a wonderful life skill for women our age. And one of the stories I tell in the book is about my friend Yolanda's mother. And she was on her deathbed. She was in hospice, and Yolanda was with her. And this mother had never taken medications in her life, either prescription or over the counter. She just didn't believe in medication. But she was dying of cancer and she was in a lot of pain. And a doc came in and offered her some morphine. And she started to say no, but then she looked at Yolanda, who was nodding yes, and she said, okay. So this doctor gave her a big shot of morphine. And she said to her daughter, I've made a terrible mistake with my life. I should have been using drugs long ago. And they both started to laugh. And that's a really typical way that women, even in dire situations, can orchestrate self-rescue by humor. It's a transcendent response, really, to a very difficult situation. Another skill that's very important is the skill of gratitude. It's a nice, fluffy skill. It's a survival skill. And one thing that was very interesting to me as I wrote this book is the people who have the most gratitude are not the people who've had the easiest lives. They're the people who have suffered. Because what they've realized is the way to balance suffering is to be grateful for that which one has. So that it's interesting to see that there's a kind of a calculus that more that is lost, that which remains is more deeply appreciated.
Huh. You know... You're so absolutely right. I'm constantly ranting and raving about waking up. You know, first of all, when you open your eyes, first thing, I mean, everyone who knows me knows that my middle name is, can we laugh about this a little bit? Because I love humor. Yeah. As a physician, I just see it so healing. So when I open up my eyes in the morning, the first thing I think is, damn, I'm still here. I'm just happy. That's a good thing. I'm here. The second thing is to kind of...
That's a really good
You know
way
what I'm saying?
Well,
yeah. I mean, there's nothing guaranteed here. And there you go. And then you rattle off your gratitudes and back and forth. You know, another chapter that really struck home, especially, and you're obviously extremely well aware of the statistics on loneliness and solitude. Ironically, it's occurring in two extremes in the ages. You know, the young people now so isolated with their devices and really not having that richness of interpersonal play and all the rest of it. And then you have clearly older people. There was just a recent survey on older people who are in a more rural type of locale as well. And you and the quote you use at the beginning of this chapter is, life may be brimming over with experiences, but somewhere deep inside, all of us carry a vast and fruitful loneliness wherever we go. How do you address the loneliness and solitude? How could you share that with our podcast listeners?
Well, first of all, I make a great distinction between loneliness and solitude because, in fact, one of the ways to deal with loneliness is to turn it into solitude. But loneliness comes from the feeling of being deprived of love, not being connected to other people. Solitude really, from my point of view, comes from a very different place, which is an enjoyment of one's own company. And one of the things I say in this book is, it's never too late to be a happy person. And of course, none of us are happy all the time. And at least speaking for myself, I wasn't born a naturally sunny person. There's a set of skills we can acquire that help us with everything from loneliness to loss to being self-critical and so on. And one of the things that really helps with loneliness is just simply making more efforts to be connected to people. You know, I have a whole chapter on the wonderfulness of women friends, and I call them my emotional mental health insurance policy. Now, you don't need to have a lot of friends, but if you can somehow manage to have a few friends that you can confide in and talk to, that's a great cure for loneliness.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that, you know, a complaint I hear a lot about, Mary, is, you know, when women say it's harder to make friends later in life. It's an interesting thing. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And they said, well, you know, it's so nice to be able to have had someone you could say, well, I've known her for the last 35 years. And, you know, all I have to do is just be in her presence. And it's just the easiest. It's hard to go out there now and to make friends. And, you know, quite frankly, my bias is I always scratched my head and said, I can make friends with a doorknob. I mean, I just, you know, I see you know, I see life as an adventure. And, you know, what the heck? You just never know. I mean, how do you, you know, a lot of women really fear, you know, putting themselves out there. I think part of it is they bought into the old, you know, shut up and be invisible thing. And, you know, I always try to, again, use humor and just say, hey, I found one of the easiest ways to be able to get women to do that extraordinarily important thing, and that is connect, is to be of service. Okay, just be of service.
That's right.
Someone
That's
out there
a very
needs
good
you.
Way.
Right?
Absolutely. That's a very good way. And there's all kinds of ways. That's, you know, being of service gives a person a sense of meaning and purpose in their life, which I think is as important as our need for oxygen. And there's almost always a way any of us can be of service. For example, one thing I do when I'm low and just feel like I need to cheer myself up is I think, is there anybody in the universe who would be happier if I gave them a phone call now? And if I can come up with a name, I'll call them up and see how they're doing. But there's always ways, I think, that we can be of service that connect us to other people. Another thing is to simply join a rec center or go to a library writing group. Or there's so many different kinds of clubs and organizations. There's senior centers and that kind of thing. But also, one of the things I talk a lot about in the book is how beautiful it is to be connected to family. And talking, of course, about living family members, children and siblings and the people that are in our lives. But I'm also talking about, at least for me, my family members who are gone are still of great comfort to me. And for example, there was a night I was having a lot of trouble getting to sleep. And the way I was able to go to sleep was to remember my grandmother's kitchen. And this particular grandmother had always loved me. And she referred to me as my Mary. And she made a real effort when our family visited to make sure that I had molasses cookies in the cookie jar. And she'd say, "Now, Mary, you come help me with dishes." And then when we got out in the kitchen alone, she'd say, "Now, let's do these dishes real slowly so we can talk." So this grandmother was very special to me. And when I was lying there, stressed out, worried about whatever it was that night, just opening the cabinets in her kitchen in my mind and remembering where the saucers were and the plates and how the little plants were arranged over her sink, and then the next cabinet over, and I fell asleep in there somewhere. So I think there's ways that we can remember people from the past for comfort, and we can also remember the people that are currently in our lives for comfort.
I absolutely love it. I'm just curious, how did you come up with the title? What was going on? Titles are always so interesting. It's like an art form. People who are not authors don't get it. Right.
Well, first of all, I wanted it to have a water title, like Reviving Oak Hill, because they're bookend books. One explores what I hope is a different story about adolescent girls, and this one explores what I hope is a very different story about older women. So I wanted that water connection between the two of them. North, of course, is evocative of winter, and winter is evocative of old age. But rowing was the really critical word. And rowing came from this sense that to be happy at this age, we need to push ourselves. If we don't push ourselves to grow, if we don't get better, if we don't grow bigger, we get bitter. And if we don't develop new identities and new strengths and new skills, we become a sort of diminished version of who we were in our 50s. And that's not a happy place to be in old age. So I think it's a portal. It's a portal that gives us an opportunity to grow in ways that are beautiful. We can grow, for example, toward more self-acceptance. And we can develop more self-care skills and finally learn to love that wild, crazy, needy baby inside ourselves. So I try to talk about old age not as if, you know, it's a very difficult life stage, but rather as if we're growing toward the light, as if there's some really marvelous and promising things that can come from this life stage.
Oh, I just absolutely love this. You know, I'm smiling widely. You can't see me because I'm a triathlete. Yes. So I spend a lot of time in the water, and I'm always swimming against some current, and I'm working my little behind off, and I've done tons of rowing. And I just smiled saying, oh, man, I could just feel it, you know, because it's a lot of work. Yeah. It's effort. And I think a lot of people may assume, you know, that you can just succeed without putting in that work. But, you know, I mean, the work's been there all your life. It just changed. The nature of the work in many respects changed, you know.
Actually,
you know what I'm saying? And so that's kind of where I went. In your last chapter, there were a couple little pieces here that I just thought were fabulous. And you have a beautiful, beautiful way of creating a picture and telling a story. And that was the three-legged cat, end of it. And, you said we have a three-legged cat that comes onto our property to eat the food that we set out for birds and foxes. The first time my grandson saw this cat, he burst into tears. She's skinny, mangy, and most likely perpetually hungry. She can't run very fast and could easily be the victim of an owl, hawk, or coyote. Yet somehow she's survived for the last couple of years. This winter, after a cold gray week, the temperature rose by 30 degrees and the sun came out. I looked out my window and saw the three-legged cat eating birdseed on our driveway. After her feast, She rolled around on her back with her paws in the air. Then she licked herself and stretched, clearly blissed out to be lying in a sunbeam. I thought to myself, I want to feel as ecstatic as that cat. Bliss doesn't happen because we are perfect or problem-free, but rather because over the years, we have become wise enough to occasionally be present for the moment. We have acquired the capacity to appreciate what simply is. Dear sisters, I hope that we can experience bliss. I want us to sense how big life is, how intense, joyful, painful, complicated, and beautiful our lives can be. Let us embrace everything. This can be our rescue as we navigate this last stretch of the river with its treacherous currents, quicksand, deep, clear waters, and silver sunsets. Just beautiful.
Thank you. You read that really beautiful. Well, Pamela.
Well, I just want to, what I'm really doing is I'm trying to get you to invite me to just go on your book tour so I could read everywhere. Because I just,
oh, bless your heart.
I love this
well,
thing.
Well, I will see you in D.C. Is that true? You'll be in politics and
are you kidding me? I mean, it's on my calendar. You don't want to know how many women I've invited to this thing. Every one of them saying yes, and they've already got your book. So, you know, you're going to have a lot of book signings. It's just amazing. From the bottom of my heart and on behalf of the women who are listening on the Her podcast, we cannot begin to thank you enough for your brilliant work and now for this new book, which you have gifted us with, which I want every single woman out there, I don't care what your age is, to read, because, you know, if you're 20, here's your heads up. If you're 30, here's your heads up. If you're 70, yeah, that's you. So this is how you navigate it. So it's an intergenerational play, and I just love it. The name of the book is Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age, by the New York Times bestselling author, Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. That's spelled P as in Pam, I-P-H-E-R. There's a PhD after that. And you could go to her website, which is marypfeiffer.com. Mary, thank you for being on the Her podcast. We can't thank you enough.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much. And everyone out there, hit iTunes right now. Rate and review this show. This has been superb. I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed doing this episode. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Her podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay well.